This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Steven Pinker, who is the Johnston Family Professor in the Department of Psychology at Harvard University. He's the author of 8 books, including The Language Instinct, How the Mind Works, Words and Rules, The Blank Slate, The Stuff of Thought, and most recently, The Better Angels of Our Nature, Why Violence Has Declined. Professor Pinker, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
Montreal, Quebec, Canada.
And looking back, what was the impact of family life on you? A lot of discussion around the dinner table?
There certainly was. It was part of the Jewish minority within the English minority, within the French minority, within the Canadian English majority. As with a lot of Jewish families, there's a lot of conversation over the dinner table and with friends and family. There's an old saying, 10 Jews, 11 opinions. It was a time as well as a place that was ripe for speculations on human nature, because it was the 60s. I'm a baby boomer. I was born in the peak of the baby boom, 1954. And although I was too young to be a participant in the protests of the 1960s, it was certainly on everyone's lips. And questions arose like, what kind of species are we, and what kind of political arrangement best suits us? Should we all be anarchists? Are people naturally cooperative unless the state forces them to declare their property? Or do we need a police force and a government to keep us from each other's throats? Or should we all be communists? Should we all be Ayn Rand libertarians? These were topics that were on everyone's lips, and certainly got me thinking from an early age.
Was there anything distinctive about the 60s in Montreal that was different than what was happening here in the United States?
Well, there was I think it was even more intensely political, because the question of the separation of Quebec into its own sovereign state was always on the agenda. And so it was a bit like Israel and South Africa, in that every conversation had a political dimension. It was just on everyone's minds, because the government was becoming increasingly nationalistic, was imposing various laws to preserve and promote the French language. And that also raised the question of whether nationalism, ethnic pride, was a good thing, especially when it was occurring simultaneously with questions of Zionism. Should there be a Jewish state? Should Jews move to Israel as part of the destiny of the Jewish people? To what extent is the identity of a person aligned with the ethnic group to which they belong?
So it sounds like ethnicity, political questions, questions of identity were really something you were hearing a lot of.
That is true. And in Montreal, I had the additional experience that one of these debates, namely, is anarchism the best political system, which in the 1960s was a live issue, was kind of put to an empirical test. I remember arguing with my parents, saying, well, we don't really need police, money, government. People will naturally cooperate. And they say, what do you think would happen if the police disappeared? I said, well, nothing. I mean, it was just irrational to steal and rape and kill, and people would realize that. And one of the things about living in a kind of Gallic political system like Quebec is that sooner or later every public sector goes on strike. One week it's the garbage collectors, and then the nurses, and then the postal workers. Anyway, in 1969, it was the police who went on strike. And within a few hours, all hell broke loose. There was looting and riots. Not one, but two people were shot to death until the Mounties were brought in to restore order. So that was a kind of empirical disconfirmation of my 14-year-old self's favorite political theory, namely anarchism. And I realized that, you know, mom and dad might have a point.
So are you suggesting that even at this young age you were already something of a thinker, and that this shock of recognition led you to think, have an inkling that you wanted to think about human nature?
Yeah, I don't think it was that event alone, but the whole set of events coming from different directions, from the 60s, from Sunday school, where I was first a student, then a teacher, and debating moral dilemmas, from the issues in Quebec, the issues in the news, all of them combined. And I think in combination with my own temperament, we know that people vary in terms of their thirst for abstract ideas. There are people whose cognitive energy is focused on people, others on things, others on practical issues. But then there are some people who just like ideas for their own sake, and I think that's the kind of genetic hand I inherited.
And what is the impact, in your view, of the Jewish milieu on your evolution, so to speak?
Well, it certainly didn't imbue me with any long-lasting religious feelings, because I am a very clear-cut atheist and secularist and cosmopolitan. I don't believe that people's identities are have to be bound up with that of some tribe or ethnic group. On the other hand, it's a background, a tradition that I have a great deal of affection for. I think it's only human to be interested in your tribal roots, as long as you don't take them too seriously as having any kind of political importance. I think that the tradition of debate and kind of Talmudic rabbinical back and forth was something that I thrived in. I was not Orthodox. I was brought up in a Reform movement, which was, you know, pretty secular, tried to preserve some of the traditions largely for aesthetic grounds, had a strong historical component, remember the Holocaust, had a strong Zionist component, but it wasn't hugely theological.
Mm-hmm. And bringing the Pinker analyst and linguist psychologist to the table to look back at your background, is most of it sort of secondary to the genes and the makeup here that account for your journey?
I suspect the genes had a lot to do with it, that there'd be a wide variety of families I could have grown up in and still had the same kinds of interests. I think as far as non-genetic influences go, the culture and the times are enormously important. Mm-hmm. I may have gone in a very different direction had I come of age in the 50s instead of the 60s and 70s. And of course, I had to have the stimulation of an information-rich society with magazines and books and newspapers and electronic media. But I think we do tend to underestimate the genetic component just because we never see it operating, because few of us are adopted. So we have this enormous confound in our autobiographical memories between the way we were brought up by our parents and the genetic hand they dealt us. Only when you do studies with adoptees do you actually see the effects of genetics in action.
Mm-hmm. So where did you do your undergraduate work?
At McGill University in Montreal, kind of the default. My parents went to McGill, and it's just kind of, there's a natural conveyor belt that led most kids to the local university.
And what did you major in, and why did you major in that?
I majored in psychology. I started off college. Prior to going to McGill, I went through the Province of Quebec's junior college system. I went to Dawson College for 2 years. And I tried a variety of social sciences, anthropology, sociology, also philosophy, various humanities courses, biology. Psychology seemed to me to be to combine an interest in big questions. What are human beings like? What's the nature? How do we communicate? How do we think? What is our emotional repertoire? But with a methodology that held up hope of resolving those questions, namely laboratory studies. And so the combination of it being an empirical science and asking cosmic questions was what appealed to me.
And did you do much humanities work as an undergraduate?
Yeah, I took English course in English pretty much every semester. I certainly took a fair number of history courses and a lot of philosophy. So yeah.
So we're going to talk a little about your work as a linguist, as a psychologist. As a scientist, really, in a way. But I always like to ask my guests what you see as the skill in set and the temperament involved in the kind of work you do, which is actually comprehending many fields.
Yeah. I think it's trying to see the simplicity underneath the complexity, that it's not being satisfied with some abstract fancy overarching summary statement, but trying to think about the nitty-gritty mechanisms underneath it. What concretely does language mean? What goes on in a person's mind, millisecond by millisecond, as they retrieve a noun with which to begin a sentence, and then a verb with which to continue it? Each step of which is very simple, but in combination, generate the full complexity of the phenomenon. So I think of myself as having a very narrow bottleneck in my mind through which everything must pass. So I've got to dismantle everything and put it through that little ring and then reassemble it on the other side before I feel I really understand it.
So it's really a zeroing in. It's almost an engineer skill of thinking about how this works by breaking up its parts.
Yeah, and I think of psychology as a kind of reverse engineering. We've got this complex artifact, the human brain. How does it work? And in particular, what was it designed to do? Now, of course, not literally designed, because I'm not a creationist. But as with other products of evolution, there is a kind of simulacrum of design that is the result of natural selection. Just as we understand physical organs like the liver or the eye as having a biological function, so the mind and its various parts, I think, are most insightfully understood by trying to figure out what their function is. Why do we fall in love? Why do we speak and understand? Why do we see in depth? why are we disgusted? Why do we fight? Why don't we fight at other times? And I think that the ultimate answers to a lot of those questions come from the process that gave rise to the complexity of the brain, and that has to be the process of natural selection.
There must be a lot of patience involved in what you do. I know some of your early work was with children and so on. So is that another element here that becomes very important?
It sure is. And there has to be, especially in the field of psychology, in any empirical science, there has to be a certain love of data, of just getting your hands dirty, sifting through it, looking for, trying to puzzle solve, what are the patterns, what are the misleading patterns that you should ignore when at the end of the day. And in fact, when people, like students, ask me what field should I go into, I'm interested in the human mind. Should I go into artificial intelligence? Should I go into psychology? Should I go into linguistics, philosophy of mind, neuroscience? I say that the choice of the actual field as opposed to the topic depends on how you like to spend your day. What do you concretely like to do? If you like to write code, go into artificial intelligence. If you are content to analyze sentences on a page, linguistics is how you should spend your time. If you like lab work and you don't mind wet stuff, go into neuroscience. But if you like the idea of experimenting with people, if you like going through lots of numbers and seeing their patterns, then go into psychology. And they're often very surprised, because people think of their career in terms of the content that interests them. And obviously that's the starting point. But just as important is what are the actual activities that occupy your waking hours.
Let's go back now to your education. So where did you do your graduate work?
I went to the psychology department at Harvard, and I got my PhD at Harvard. Then I did a postdoctoral fellowship at the Center for Cognitive Science at MIT down the river.
And what led you to particular, the many fields that you've actually entered? Was it one research project led to another, or was it more what you just said about?
Yeah, it's one research. One thing leads to another. And I think when people reconstruct their autobiographies, they're much too apt to impose a satisfying narrative arc on it and to have everything foreshadowed by early events. Whereas I suspect any honest biographer looking at anyone's trajectory would see that there's a lot of happenstance and opportunities and what was around at the time, and people just sort of followed a path, making a choice at every point that seemed like the right thing to do at the time. And that was certainly the case with me. I went into graduate school not interested in language per se. I was interested in cognitive psychology, so that's really anything having to do with intelligent processes in the mind. My PhD thesis was on visual imagery, how people imagine objects and scenes and manipulate them in their mind's eye. But I started to do work in language in large part because Harvard at the time had just denied tenure to every cognitive psychologist except one who'd studied language development in children. I took a stimulating graduate seminar with her. That was kind of all that was around, and wrote a paper for a course that she and other professors said was could be of interest to the field as a whole. Why didn't I polish it for publication? I was worried about being unemployed. This was the era in which PhDs were first reported driving taxis and unemployed. And
this would be the 70s?
The 70s. You know, we hear about it now, but it was the first wave of that worry was when I was a grad student. So I kind of pursued the opening. I developed this theoretical paper into a publication. I was then hired back at Harvard a couple of years later to teach courses in language acquisition. And because I had to teach it and because I had to supervise students in it, my interest in it deepened. All the while, I continued to pursue research in visual attention, recognition of three-dimensional shapes, mental transformations. Then I kind of responded to feedback from the world. The field was telling me that it found my writings on language acquisition more interesting than my work in visual cognition. I got more invitations. Publications were more easily accepted, and I kind of got feedback from the field as to what everyone else thought was most interesting in my portfolio.
But before we talk a little more about particular aspects of your research, capture for us the intellectual excitement that was there in the beginning when you started graduate school, but also the over the life of your career, there must be amazing intellectual excitement about the way the brain is opening up, not just in the research, but also the research of the brain, but visually with all the technology and so on.
Yeah, I was. I usually pursue a topic when I find some source of tremendous excitement, when it just feels like there are whole vistas to be explored. And I felt that way as an undergraduate, just learning about what was then a new field called cognitive psychology. Psychology had been dominated for many decades by behaviorism, the philosophy of psychology advocated by B.F. Skinner, that mental entities like beliefs, desires, wishes, images, rules were suspect. They were unmeasurable, hence unscientific, and should be banished from a science of psychology, which should only be about behavior. This was a dominant school for a long time, but for obvious reasons, it was quite constricting. Starting in the 50s and 60s, with the importing of ideas from other fields like computer science, cybernetics, information theory, psychologists started to realize you could study intelligence scientifically without banishing the contents of the mind, that thinking could be thought of as a kind of information processing or computation, that motives and desires and emotions could be understood in the language of cybernetics and feedback, that knowledge and belief could be thought of as a kind of information representation. And so you could be rigorous and study these abstract, ethereal, airy-fairy concepts like beliefs and desires. So that was a tremendously exciting opportunity, and there was the cognitive revolution that pursued this starting in the late 50s, and it was the momentum from that, you know, with a bit of a time lag, that as an undergraduate got me interested in cognitive psychology. And then when I got to MIT as a postdoc, this is many years later, this is 1979, there was a lot of things that were happening that were advancing this agenda of understanding the mind as a kind of information processing. There were theories of grammar from Noam Chomsky and my postdoctoral advisor, Joan Bresnan, who I learned linguistics from. There were ideas from computational analysis of vision from the great computational neuroscientist David Marr, who was at MIT at the time. Their philosophy of mind had kind of joined forces with experimental scientists to try to make sense of questions like imagery, innateness, rule following, which had also been banned from philosophy, but now philosophers were exploring this landscape. And so that all of those ideas combined into the field that then became called cognitive science, not just psychology, but also philosophy, linguistics, computer science, led to an enormous amount of energy and enthusiasm. Later, that got kind of started to bleed away under the new developments in neuroscience. The first wave had not given a whole lot of attention to the physical structure of the brain, and then that became the next wave, and starting in the late 80s and 90s. But then at other times, I found other ideas. It seemed to be there was a world to be explored in the particular areas within cognitive science that I then pursued.
It sounds to me like you're saying in a way that it's not just other disciplines seeping in to one's discipline, but rather to be truly interdisciplinary is the road to dealing with some very interesting problems. So you're really a man who transcends any one discipline in the different kinds of work you've done. Is that fair?
I think so. So even though I do advise students to live with the reality of academic disciplines and to choose their career based on concrete activities they like to do, in terms of understanding things, the disciplines are something of a nuisance, of a kind of a historical legacy that we should try to surmount. If you're understanding language, it is, I think, folly to study it only from the perspective of linguistics or of psychology or computer science. It's all phenomena are connected, all knowledge is connected, and we need all the tools we can get. It's hard to understand anything. To restrict yourself to one discipline really means putting on blinkers and not getting a full picture.
What do you see, having studied the brain and your own experiences in life, what is the key to creativity? I mean, you've been dealing with ideas, you know, back in Montreal at the dinner table, it sounds like, and sort of experiencing the events of the 60s. Talk a little about that, because Is it interdisciplinary work that exposes you to all of these new ideas in the various fields you've dealt with?
Yes, certainly. And studies of creativity show that it doesn't consist of just lightning bolts of inspiration out of the blue, that creative people always immerse themselves in vast amounts of material from their the field that they're interested in. Novelists read lots of novels, and musicians have huge record collections, and someone interested in ideas has to absorb a vast number of ideas that have been thought of by others. No one is smart enough, or at least I'm not smart enough, to come up with anything truly original and useful on my own. it always involves getting inspiration from a vast kind of feedstock of other ideas. And this consists not of partly of absorbing ideas from other fields that might be directly relevant, and they can come from all kinds of sources, from game theory, from theoretical computer science, but also seeing being able to combine ideas from diverse fields into a new conglomerate that where the newness is putting things together that had never been put together, and from a kind of process of analogy that that I'm actually interested in as a cognitive psychologist, why there's a kind of mental analogical reminding process where one idea reminds you of another that doesn't really have anything in common on the surface, but has a deep commonality in terms of their underlying structure. So an example, I'm working on Photoshop and I'm darken one part of the image and I darken it too much so it stands out, so I got to darken another one, and oh, now I darkened that too much, now and before I know it, the whole image is dark. And I'm immediately thinking of a wobbly table and how you cut off a little bit of one leg, and oh, now it wobbles. You've got to cut off part of another leg. Or I'm jogging, and I have music set to shuffle on my iPod, and some of the songs are the wrong tempo, but I can't sort of stop and pick the songs, so I just fast forward through song after song until I get the one that's suitable for running. It reminds me of how in baseball, a pitcher can't signal to the catcher what he's going to pitch, and so he shakes off or nods to the various pitches selected by the catcher, and that's how they communicate. So these are very different domains, but they have an abstract underlying structure. In one case, adjusting something to a desired criterion but overshooting in one local area and having to compensate in others. In another case, selecting something by going through a set of alternatives and rejecting each one until the desired one comes up in the set. That process, which I'm interested in as a psychologist, I think also can apply to coming up with new ideas as a scientist. So trying to understand, for example, why violence is so prevalent throughout human history. What's the what's the common thread across so many different times and places? Well, there's a problem in game theory called the prisoner's dilemma on how what can be advantageous for each rational player in isolation works to the disadvantage of two of them in combination. And that's usually described in terms of two partners in crime who are being bribed by the DA with different prison sentences. But it also applies to the dilemma of whether you should attack someone at the risk of being attacked by them, or both should lay down your arms. And that reminding led me to work out a prisoner's dilemma like Matrix for the dilemma of violence and conversely how one can escape it and strive toward peace. So I think that creativity depends on deep analogies.
And what is involved in going down one of these paths? To what extent do you navigate between mastery of a subject and being superficial about a subject that's not your main subject?
I think you do have to immerse yourself in another field. I don't believe there's some scientists who think I want to approach a problem fresh and I don't want to read about that field. I don't want to be contaminated. I want my creativity to be unsullied. And I think that's a big mistake. Mm-hmm. My approach has always been read deeply in the other field. There are other people who know a lot more than you do. Respect what they have done. You can see what blunders they might have made or other people have made. You can learn from their mistakes. And so I always try to become an honorary member of whatever field I'm writing in. Go to the conferences, find out the gossip, find out the standards of status and competition and what generates them. It gives you more insight when you actually read the field. So yeah, I always, I think there is a big danger in being a dilettante and it should be resisted.
There's a conflict, a dilemma is what I want to use, in your work, in the sense that working on particular problems in a narrow field, say linguistics, but then also moving to address general topics. So you begin with language and dealing with irregular verbs in children.
Right.
And you most recently write a major tome on violence. So I'm curious about how you've navigated this movement from one end of the spectrum to the other. And I believe you think both works are very important at getting at the problem that you see as central, which is understanding human nature.
Yes, and human nature is the common thread between, you know, irregular verbs and genocide. At first glance, wouldn't seem to have a whole lot in common. But both of them are products of human mind. I spent a lot of my career studying irregular verbs, not just because of fascination with linguistic detail, but because I thought they were a good way to get at cognitive architecture. What is the what are the elementary mental steps that go on in the brain when you understand and produce a sentence? And my argument was that if you compare irregular verbs like bring, brought, come, came, make, made, which don't follow a rule and have to be just memorized, compare them with regular forms like blog, blogged, mosh, moshed, Google, googled, where they do follow a rule. And moreover, when a new word comes into the language, like to Google, you don't have to go to the dictionary to look up its past tense form. You just generate it by a mental rule at ED. You're getting the two components of language, and I even argue two components of mental life in general, that the drive intelligence, namely memory lookup and online combination. And they're equated for meaning, two ways of talking about something that happened in the past. They're almost the same in terms of complexity, but they tap different, so I argue, different cognitive systems. So it's a very particular phenomenon that can be studied in a lot of depth and richness, but it has implications for fundamental issues. Now, the common denominator between that and, you know, say, genocide is just that it is human nature. And the trajectory that took me there was as follows. I argued that to understand language, one of the things you have to understand is the innate basis that makes language acquisition possible, an idea associated with Noam Chomsky, although I wouldn't put it the same way he does. But just, you know, learning requires a learning mechanism. The learning mechanism has to be innate. To understand learning, you've got to understand the innate part. They're not dichotomous. The question, if we have a specialization for acquiring language, what other specializations does the brain come with? Led me to how the mind works, and where I talked about other components of the mind, like the emotions, fear, disgust, love, perception, depth, color, motion, shading, reasoning, number, probability, shape, other people's minds, physical objects, and so on. And I tried to give a kind of an inventory of the, or an anatomy of cognition. Well, then that led to the question, a lot of, is there something, you know, dangerous or retrograde or reactionary about positing a human nature? If evolution gave the mind a certain structure, does that mean that it's hopeless to try to make the world a better place because people are wired with ugly motives like jealousy and greed and dominance, and so hope for progress is futile because people just screw it up no matter what you do? It's human nature. We're built that way. And I got a lot of political pushback of the idea of human nature along those lines, and that's kind of a left-wing kind of a objection. The right-wing objection is, well, if you're saying that it's all machinery, it's all evolved neural circuitry, where does that leave the soul and free will and responsibility? And isn't it giving people an excuse to act in accord with Darwinian instincts? My adaptations made me do it. My amygdala made me do it. And are you undercutting all morality and decency by pushing a biological understanding of the mind? So I dealt with that in a book called The Blank Slate, The Modern Denial of Human Nature, denying the premise that a belief in human nature somehow undercuts hopes for progress or meaning or morality. That, on the contrary, I think a robust understanding of human nature is a prerequisite to making the world a better place. You've got to look at what humans are like in order to figure out what could make them behave better.
And in that book, The Blank Slate, you really argue against people saying there's a blank slate and you can undertake all these programs that will make them better.
That's right. So the title of The Blank Slate was the title of the idea I was arguing against, mm-hmm. the idea that the mind has no structure, that we are simply programmed by parents, society, culture, media images, and so on. And in the blank slate, I pointed out that it's not just a question of kind of philosophical analysis that human nature does not logically imply fatalism about the human condition. But you just open your eyes and you look at the human condition and you see it obviously has improved. We aren't involved in constant tribal warfare where women from one band are abducted by another. We don't burn heretics at the stake or break people on the wheel. We don't have legalized slavery. I made that point in The Blank Slate, and then I reiterated it as the answer to a question posed on a online forum, edge.org, where one year John Brockman asked 100 scientists, what are you optimistic about? And I listed some of these observations. The Soviet Empire vanished without hardly any violence. Apartheid was dismantled, slavery abolished, human sacrifice, and so on. Then I started to get, as soon as it was posted, I got a flood of mail from scholars in fields I was barely aware of saying, you know, there's much more of an evidence for a decline of violence than you even realized. Mm-hmm. I got letters from people in your field, international studies, saying, well, you may not be aware that people in international studies have been shaking their heads in disbelief over the decline of great power war. That since World War II, the world's 800-pound gorillas have stopped fighting with each other, which they did for half a millennium before. Another group that keeps track of war on a year-by-year basis said, well, we plot war deaths, and here our curves go like that. I had a colleague in psychology at Harvard who said, oh, you could have added that rates of child abuse are down, rates of spousal abuse are down, approval of spanking is down. A historical criminologist said in every European country for which data exist, rates of homicide have gone down over the centuries. I started thinking, this is amazing. There are all of these curves that plot violence, and they all look like that, and no one knows about it. And this matters. Is there such a thing as progress? Is there such a thing as enlightenment? Have the strivings of the human race for the last few thousand years made us better off or worse off? It's hard to think of a more fundamental question than that, and everyone has the wrong answer. Wrong in the sense that whenever you try to test it empirically, you see things are getting better, not worse. And contrary to the image of the world projected by journalism, which is there are crisis after crisis and the world is going to hell in a handcart. So I thought, first of all, being privy to all of these data, I should try to make them known. But more interestingly, as a student of human nature, how could I try to make sense of all of these trends going in the same direction? First of all, why were our ancestors so violent? Why is the default in human life, I think, some rate of violence that today we would not accept? And what did our ancestors do to drive it down? What are the degrees of freedom? What's the plasticity in human behavior that would allow a rate of homicide to fall by a factor of 50 over 800 years, or that would subtly allow people to stop going to war? And so there was a meaty scientific problem as well as a phenomenon that I thought should be better known.
Before we talk about some of your conclusions there, let's go back a minute because I want to cut into two insights that come from your work, which I gathered just reading your stuff and not doing it justice in preparation for this interview. One is that neuroscience and all the scanning technology now enable us to really see the physiological basis or come to an understanding of the physiological basis behind the activity of the brain, which begins to answer the question of the mind-body dichotomy. That's very important insight.
Well, I think at the most global level of understanding what the mind is, certainly the fact that it's implemented in brain tissue is a indispensable part of the story. I don't think there's a soul, there's no free-floating entity called the mind that is anything other than activity of in neural networks. On the other hand, in order to understand human affairs, the level of brain physiology and anatomy may not be the most perspicuous one. It may not give you the insight that you want, even though ultimately that's where it all is. Sometimes you have to look at a higher level of analysis, at the content of ideas, at the social networks that propagate ideas, and your answer may not be uncovered by studies of neural networks. Just as if you're criticizing a movie, you get your DVD, and the movie is nothing but the little pits in the DVD. But on the other hand, if I ask you, is this an original film? Is it a witty film? Is it a hackneyed film? Putting the DVD under a microscope and looking at the pits is just not going to give you the answer, even though that there's nothing that isn't in those pits, but it's just not the most enlightening way to study it. And so I think that brain imaging experiments, functional neuroimaging, are part of the story, but they make sense only to the extent that you have an idea of what the different systems of the brain are designed to do and what content they're processing, not just whether they're on or off.
And when we look at a theme that runs through your work, in addition to the particulars which we just discussed, it's really about how the mind works to really engage reality and to preserve social relations as they develop. That's sort of key, is it not? You're moving from language to the study of violence, for example.
Right. So if I were to step back and say, what's the deal with Homo sapiens? What makes us what we are? Why are we such a weird primate? I think it's a combination of three major things. One of them being know-how, that we figure out how the world works and we manipulate it to our advantage with tools and other things to a much greater extent than any other animal. We have language, so we can share the fruits of our discoveries and we can coordinate our behavior in large ensembles by striking deals with each other. And we are social. We cooperate with non-relatives. Very unusual in the animal kingdom. But we have that triad, each one of which supports the other two, and that's the starting point for understanding our very odd species. From that, questions like how do we learn, what is education for, when do we get along, when do we not get along, what would allow us to get along better, I think has to refer back to our nature as a species, including that triad. And by the way, it's because of our capacity for know-how, for coming up with new ideas, that believing in human nature does not make you a fatalist. You aren't just stuck with the way we've always done things, not because of any magic, not because any soul transcends our biological limitations, but because one of the bits of our biology can crank out new ideas by combining old ideas through analogy and composition. And so the reason we're not stuck with the way we've always done things is that we can come up with new ideas and we can share them through language. We can keep the ones that work, tinker with them, and that is a kind of an avenue towards improving our lot, given the materials we have to work with.
As you've moved from language to a study of violence, one of your tools has been the extent to which your writing is so clear and lucid. Especially the book on violence is just a great read. Talk a little about that, how writing has been an important tool and what you've learned about the brain that helps you understand its importance.
Yeah, so writing is itself a topic that interests me, both because that's one of the things I do, so I try to increase my readership by writing in a clear and engaging way. But, of course, it's also part of the content of what I study, namely how language works. And so I've always been interested in what are the processes that I as a writer and I as a reader go through that make me resonate to a well-crafted sentence or stumble at a bloated and turgid or opaque one. In fact, I've combined those interests in my next book called The Sense of Style, which is a writing manual, but one that is based in findings from cognitive science and linguistics. Most style manuals, by the way, one of my favorite genres of literature. I love reading style manuals, and I have for many decades. But they're based generally on the intuitions and personal experience of journalists and writers, and they have tended not to be systematic. The writers kind of have hunches, they have feelings, they have intuitions, they have the writerly ear. But can we do better and say what are the steps that take place as a person reads a sentence such that some kinds of sentences allow the whole process to go smoothly and others gum it up?
And what are some of your findings? Do you want to share any of those with you?
Sure.
In particular, yeah.
Some of them are that because writing is an unnatural act, we evolved to speak, but we didn't evolve to write. Therefore, one of the first things you have to do as a writer is imagine what kind of situation you're pretending to be in, that you're simulating as you write. Your reader is not physically present. They can't react with facial expressions. They can't furrow their brows. They can't interrupt you and say, "What the hell does that mean?" So, how do you? What social situation should you simulate in order to write clearly? That's the first step, and I think that the answer to that is, you are pointing to something in the world that you want your reader to see, and you're giving them an unobstructed view. Now, that's an image of what you're pretending to do as you write, the conversation you're pretending to have. And a lot of concrete bits of writerly advice all fall out of that central image of what are you pretending to simulate. Things like avoiding a lot of signposting and meta-discourse. Now that we've analyzed this, I'm going to discuss the following 17 points. Academics do that. It bogs down academic writing. It's not what you would do if you were having a conversation about something in the world. And so referring back to that central image allows you to deduce one of these guidelines for writing as a consequence. A second bit is to overcome the curse of knowledge. The curse of knowledge is the inability that we all have to imagine what it's like not to know something that we do know. Once you know something, it just seems second nature. You just magically project your knowledge to everyone else, and you don't realize that other people, what's obvious to you isn't obvious to them. And an enormous amount of opaque writing is that way because the writer didn't stop to think, what does someone who doesn't know my field start out thinking? Third is to understand the mechanics of syntax. These are the tools that writers have to work with, and in any craft, you've got to understand your tools. So, just knowing what is English syntax, what does it do, how does it work, how can it work poorly? So, that's another dimension. And finally, what do you do about rules of correct and incorrect usage? Don't dangle your participles, don't split your infinitives, no prepositions at the end of a sentence. Don't use confuse, mitigate, and militate. The vast majority of commentary about writing focuses on correct usage, which I actually think is the least important part of good writing, but it is something that that writers have to keep in mind. And it turns out that if you do the scholarship on where these rules came from, you realize that a lot of them are really pointless and can be blown off. The rule against splitting infinitives, ending a sentence with a preposition, is nonsense. It doesn't mean you should flout all rules. Some of them really do enhance clarity. Some of them mesh with the expectations of a literate reader, and they ought to be followed. But one should, instead of taking rules of correct usage as the Ten Commandments, they're just inerrant, you can subject them to criticism and scholarship and say, well, does this rule really help, or should we just blow it off?
Let's talk a little about the violence book. I mean, it's a massive undertaking, but what's interesting in your conclusion, in a way, the struggle is about the better angels within us, the darker, what is the term?
Inner demons.
The inner demons.
Just keeping not mixing metaphors.
Which,
yeah,
it's not a surprising analysis coming from a psychologist. But what is really interesting is in this book you move to the more general phenomena that influences which wins out, but that is the inner demons or the inner angels. Talk a little about that and what you conclude. Because if, for a reader who's looked at all of your work, is that something of a surprise that that you're looking at the big picture there?
I hope not. Indeed, I think in trying to understand the decline of violence, there are two parts of the phenomenon that need to be explained. One of them is the violence, and the other is the decline. Mm-hmm. So both are facts, at least so I argue. And I spend many pages in the book and many graphs first persuading the reader that it is a fact, that violence really has gone down, and then turn to the question of why. Well, why? It can't be that we just have this inner thirst for blood that periodically has to be slaked. Violence is not like, you know, hunger or thirst or the need for sex or the need for sleep. Clearly, it is adjusted by circumstances. And the reason it can be adjusted is that whatever violent urges we have, what I call the inner demons, things like urge for dominance, thirst for revenge, tendency towards sadism, sheer exploitation, using someone as a means to an end. That's not all there is in human nature. Human nature is complex. And together with these various temptations toward violence, we have a number of things that inhibit us from violence. We've got self-control, these massive circuits in the frontal lobe of the brain that can count to 10, hold your horses, save your money for a rainy day, and make us think twice before lashing out in violence. There's empathy. Under certain circumstances, we feel other people's pain. We don't want to hurt them. We want to prevent them from suffering. There are norms, moral norms. There are certain things you just don't do if you want to be considered a decent person. There's reason. Can we treat violence as a problem to be solved, the same way we solve problems like disease and hunger? And what changes over the balance of history, what allows over the course of history, is the balance between the inner demons and the better angels. And that's where societal, historical, institutional changes can come in. You could have institutions like government that penalize impulsive violence or predatory violence. And since we do take in information about the environment, if we think that the police are going to haul us off to jail if we stab someone over a parking space, maybe we'll think twice about stabbing someone over a parking space. If norms change so that lashing out when you're insulted is no longer a sign of manliness, but now is a sign of boorishness, then people will are more likely to adhere to that norm. If we, in general, are more enlightened and educated, and we, no matter how much we are fired up by patriotism and jingoism, we think, well, gee, you know, the other side is too, and our ancestors were, and got them into a whole lot of trouble, like in World War I, maybe we should think twice, stand back, reflect, and figure out how to get out of this pickle instead of pushing it through to the bitter end, then our cognitive processes of reason can pull us away from violence. So the three components, what makes us violent, what makes us nonviolent, what changes in our society to favor the latter over the former, that's the way I tell the story.
A couple of final questions. One is, where do you see the big breakthrough coming in our understanding of the brain?
I don't know if there will be one big breakthrough, or at least if there is, I'm probably the last one who'll be able to predict it. I think that ideas from many sources have to be combined. What I find most exciting is the breaking down of the barriers between traditional domains of humanistic scholarship, like history, like jurisprudence, like philosophy, like linguistics and philology, even music and literature and art, and bringing it together with our increasing understanding of human nature. What can our knowledge of motives like dominance and revenge tell us about the conduct of international relations? How can our understanding of visual cognition lead to insight about sculpture and painting? How does auditory analysis mesh with our understanding of music? Can there be understandings of poetics and literary style that are informed by linguistics? Now, people, many scholars in the humanities just have a hissy fit when they hear about this. They think it's reductionist, scientistic, determinist, positivist, atomist, and I think that attitude is sealing the doom of the humanities. I think there are tremendous opportunities for mutual benefit on each side, and I hope that the universities will be a place in which these opportunities for insight are explored.
And then one final question, if students watching this interview were to find insight from your intellectual journey, how would you suggest, what should they learn from your journey, and how would you advise them to prepare for the future?
Certainly to, I'm giving some somewhat contradictory advice. One of them, one piece, dealing with the realities of the academic scene as it exists, the other holding out hope for changing it. So the reality is disciplines are here. You want to get employed, you want to get tenure, respect the disciplines. On the other hand, I think that's a deplorable state of affairs, though it is the reality, and is if you want to play your part in trying to overcome this this unfortunate legacy, immerse yourself in other disciplines. Be interested in topics, ideas, problems, phenomena, not in academic guilds. Negotiating those two, that's one of the great things about tenure. Once you have tenure, it does give you the freedom to peer into what's going on in the next guy's discipline.
Well, on that note, Stephen, I want to thank you for taking time to be on our program. It was a very insightful discussion, and I think it's going to lead a lot of people to go out and read some of your books if they haven't.
Well, thanks very much, Harry.
And thank you very much for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.